Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. In the book Transcendent Kingdom, the main character uses her work in science to find answers to the suffering and loss she sees in the world around her. And we're talking about Transcendent Kingdom today with our guest, author Yah Jesse. She has a BA in English from Stanford University and MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she held a Dean's Graduate Research Fellowship. Her first book, Homegoing, won many, many awards, and she's joining us for our book club to talk about her second novel, Transcendent Kingdom, which is this year's University of Wisconsin Go Big Read book. And I hope many of you read the book. Have you read it? What'd you think? Have you had to go through a similar experience of figuring out your own relationships to others or perhaps to religion, your community? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Yah Jesse, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've written an absolutely wonderful book. I had to remember that it's, as I was reading it, that this is a novel, and it was very hard for me to do that. It's written in the first person. That's one thing, but you write in such an intimate way about Gifty, the main character in your book. It was hard for me to not think you were writing about yourself. Maybe you should tell us a little about yourself just to start.
Sure. I've heard that from many readers. It does read like memoir, but it is fiction. As for me, similarly to Gifty, I suppose, I was born in Ghana, but I grew up mostly in Huntsville, Alabama, where much of this novel is set. And I, as you read in my bio, I left Alabama to go to Stanford for a university and lived in California for many years, attended graduate school in Iowa, came back to California, and then finally made my way to New York. So I'm joining you today from Brooklyn.
I'm going to ask you this. Your first name is Yah, and I was wondering if you were born on a Thursday.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yah is the name for an Akan girl born on a Thursday.
I had a friend who spent some time in Ghana and wondered if you were born on a Thursday because of the day name, and I had to look it up and to make sure that it was correct that Yah is one of the names given females born on a Thursday. Yah is the male version, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Well, for listeners who haven't yet read the book, can you give us a summary of what the book's all about?
Sure. So the book is about a young woman named Gifty, who is a neuroscientist, and she studies this phenomenon called reward-seeking behavior, which if you don't know what that means, that's okay. Basically, she studies things like addiction and depression, and it's at a time in her own life when her mother is suffering from depression, and so she finds herself taking care of her mother while also doing this research and also thinking back to her childhood, particularly the years that led up to her beloved older brother's passing from a heroin overdose. So yeah. It's a novel about addiction and depression and family.
Addiction, depression, and family. Yeah. And as I read your book, as I read your work, I thought, oh, surely you're a neuroscientist.
I'm glad I was able to convince you of that because I am the opposite of a neuroscientist.
my goodness. I wondered about that. Until I had a chance to read a little more about you personally. I wonder, you know, we recently talked to a Wisconsin-based author, Chloe Benjamin. She has the book, The Immortalists, one of her books, about her own research process. And just as it relates to the neuroscience part of it, it must have involved a lot of research for you.
It did. And I admit that I had this shortcut, which is that I'm fortunate enough to have a dear, dear friend who is herself a neuroscientist. Her name is Tina. She studies this very phenomenon, reward-seeking behavior. I've known her since high school. And at some point, before I realized I was going to write a novel, at some point I realized that I just didn't really understand what she did all day. I didn't really understand her work at all. And so mostly out of a sense of curiosity, I asked her if I could go shadow her in her lab. And she very kindly said yes. And it was that experience of walking through the lab with her and listening to her talk about her research and thinking, I guess, about the implications that her research might have on humans and on you know, human diseases such as depression. I found it really fascinating. And the wheels started turning in my own head about whether I could, you know, make fiction out of it.
Well, you did a marvelous job. Part of my job is to teach in the Department of Life Sciences Communication here at the UW. And so what we're trying to do is help teach students how to write about science in a way that is easily understood by everyone. And I thought, as I was reading what you were writing, I thought, man, I wish I could have you come and talk to my students about your whole process, because it's a you do such a wonderful job of it. And your writing, your writing kind of goes back and forth a little bit. You go back to earlier times when you were in Ghana and also when you were not, but a young child, but. The whole business of how to fit in a community like Huntsville, Alabama, or probably anywhere else for that matter. I know many immigrants have trouble fitting in. Was that part of your own life too?
You know, it was, but not to the extent that it is for Gifty, the narrator of Transcendent Kingdom. I think with Gifty, what you see isn't just that normal trouble fitting in, but also she's being raised by a single parent, a mother who isn't as inclined to kind of create community beyond, you know, her own immediate family. So Gifty, I think, is particularly isolated, particularly lonely. As for me, like my parents, I think of as being incredibly invested in community, particularly community with other West Africans. So no matter where we lived, we actually moved to Alabama when I was 9 and had lived in a few other states before that. But no matter where we lived, one of the first things that my parents would do would be to find the phone book and look up Ghanaian last names and call those people up and say, we're new in town. Can we get together? And so I grew up with lots of West African community around me, which I think was really formative and helped keep some of that loneliness that Gifty feels in the novel at bay.
Yeah. And the relationship, obviously, between Gifty and her mother is central to the book. But I also think there are essentially 4 members of the family. There's the father and her Gifty's brother, Nana, and then the mother and Gifty. The relationship among them, I actually kind of liked Nana, the brother, seemed like the central. I mean, he was the nice guy in this in this book to me. Gifty. Yeah. Sometimes I didn't always like Gifty in the book.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot, and I think it's a response that I understand. Gifty's not. She's prickly. She's hard to get to know. She keeps people at a distance. And we can kind of see why, given the chaos of her childhood. But she's certainly not warm. And I think that Nana is the character who is the most warm. He's there for Gifty. In some ways, he's kind of almost like a unofficial parent to Gifty, because her parents have this very fractured relationship. Her mother is working all the time. Really, it's Nana who does a lot of that kind of caregiving that we expect parents to do. He makes sure that Gifty is fed. He's interested in what she's coloring. So I expect people to feel a kind of affection for Nana that they might not feel for the other characters in the book.
And he also tries to build up his mother, compliments
Yeah, it's
her.
true. Yeah, he's her. He becomes a kind of emotional support for her after their father leaves. He becomes kind of a crutch for the mother. So I think he takes that role quite seriously. You're right. He does compliment her and kind of try to shore her up a bit.
The book is so interesting because it does cause you to think a lot about these characters and the situations they were in. I was I don't know, mad is not the right word, but I didn't think much of the father at first. But then I thought a lot about, he came over and but then he left. But then I had to think about the circumstances that he was living in Huntsville, Alabama. And those was a, that had to have been, that would be a tough row to hoe, as some people say, in life.
Yeah, I think it's a side of the American dream story that we don't see portrayed very often, which is, what happens when you come to America and you find the conditions to be so kind of difficult that you can't really justify staying, which is what happens to the father. It was not his idea to come. His wife was the one who wanted to go. And then B, once he arrives, he finds the environment that they're in so hostile to him, that he can't he decides that he can't deal with it. And I think for a lot of certainly a lot of Black immigrants of a certain generation, there's a great shock of coming from a country where everyone is the same race as you, to arriving in America and having to deal with racism sometimes for the first time, in this particular kind of display of it. And so I think that's what happens to the father. He decides he would just rather be back in his home country, and so he goes back.
Yeah, it took a bit of thinking about that for me, and I understood it, his reasoning. I think I understood it anyway. Yeah, Jessie is our guest today. Her novel is titled Transcendent Kingdom, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or your thoughts about the book, or maybe questions for her, even if you haven't read the book. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Natalie Guyette's our producer today. Tyler Ditter's our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest novelist, Yah Jessie. Her book, Transcendent Kingdom. Join in with your questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. Gifty's family attends a white Pentecostal church. And they are the only Black family in the church.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you grow up in a Pentecostal church as well?
I did. This is probably the aspect of the novel that is most autobiographical. Like Gifty, I grew up in a predominantly white Pentecostal church in Alabama. And my family had always been Pentecostal, and originally, when we first came to America, we lived in Columbus, Ohio, which had a pretty large Ghanaian immigrant community, and we were members of the African Christian Church there, which was half Nigerian, half Ghanaian. And so it wasn't until we got to Alabama that we kind of saw how segregated the churches here in America can be. And we wound up in the church that was nearest to our house, which just happened to be on the predominantly white side of town.
Fred in Madison has a question for you or comment. Fred, hello. Thank you for calling.
This is a great show. I've only listened for 10 minutes, but I just want to point out, and I'm 70 years old. I've lived in 5 or 6 states in the United States, and I've lived in several other countries around the planet. In the last 20 years, it is very common for immigrants to spend time in the United States and leave not liking the United States. And I could give case histories. But the comment that I've heard from people who spend time here and then leave is the arrogance of the United States and the presumption that we are the target and the great desirable, you know, end point for history or for whatever. And it can be also xenophobic. There is a kind of anti-foreign sentiment in the U.S., which is like a fortress mentality. So I don't want to give a harangue because I know that I'm exaggerating, but I'm just saying many people come here and spend some years here and don't like it.
Mm. Fred, thank you for calling. A comment, yeah?
Yeah, I think like Fred, I know a number of people who have come and left, whether, you know, they come for school, they come for work, and they do can face this this anti-immigrant sentiment that they find too you know, too hostile to their thriving in America. And so it's not as uncommon as we might think for people to come and decide that they don't like it and return to their home countries. Yeah.
Fred, thank you again for calling. Ben in Prairie du Chien, what's on your mind?
I have a question. How was your stay in Iowa and how do you think the Iowa people?
My stay in Iowa was wonderful. I really, really enjoyed my time at the workshop, which is, you know, one of the best institutions for creative writing that we have in this country. I had wonderful teachers. Iowa City is a really charming town, and a town. It's one of the UNESCO cities of literature, and you can really feel that there's a deep love for literature in that city. So I enjoyed my time there greatly.
Ben, did you enjoy? Ben, did you live there or?
Yes, I did. I lived in a number of places in Iowa. In fact, I lived in Cedar Falls, and I lived in. Let's see, Cedar Falls, and I lived in
elsewhere. Yeah, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate that. So the time, and maybe we can just go down that road a little bit. As long as the writer's workshop came up, is that something that any writer should aspire to do?
Well, my feelings on MFA programs is that, you know, if you want to become a writer, certainly it's worthwhile, particularly and kind of only if the program is fully funded. I do not recommend going to get an MFA at a program that you have to pay for, or at a program that is in a city that's incredibly expensive to live, because then you'll have a harder time when you graduate. But as for me, Iowa is a fully funded program. It was 2 years that I got to completely devote to my writing. When I got there, I had been working at a tech startup in San Francisco, and I had no time to write. And suddenly here are these endless stretches with which I can just sit and work on my book. So that's the great gift of an MFA program like Iowa, is that you get to kind of pause for a little bit and focus just on the thing that you're working on.
Jane from Sun Prairie emailed to say they read Transcendent Kingdom for book club and loved it, especially Giftie's letters to God. And let's talk about those letters for a minute, and then I'll get to the rest of her notes. But I really love them as well. But talk about how you use those letters. I mean, we learn a little about Giftie from the letters.
Yes, that's true. I mean, as you mentioned before, pointed out before, Giftie is, she can be a kind of a difficult character. And I think part of that has to do, again, with the kind of chaos of her childhood. She's learned this coping mechanism of being guarded, of having her walls up. And so even for me as the writer, you know, getting to know Giftie was a challenge, you know, trying to find ways to say all that she wasn't saying was a challenge. And what the letters allowed me to do, the letters are from her childhood journal that she addresses to God. What they allowed me to do was to show these really vulnerable moments where Giftie is being honest. You know, she's developed these code names for all of her family members, with the code name, she allows herself to tell the truth about how she's feeling in a way that she kind of learns to cover as she gets older. And so I really loved the journals because I felt like it was an opportunity to finally see Giftie as she really was.
Jane also is wondering what triggered Giftie's mother's second major depression episode episode resulting in her moving in with Giftie.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jane. I mean, we can kind of directly trace her first major depressive episode to Nana's passing. But the second one is less clear. And I think for anyone who struggles with depression, there are those moments where you kind of can tell what sends you into the tunnel, as Giftie calls it, and sometimes you can't tell. And in this second case, I don't think Giftie ever knows. I don't think the mother ever knows. But you know, it could just be the ongoing her ongoing grief. It just gets to be too much.
And she also mentions, we tried Ensure original dark chocolate and all agreed that it is terrible.
That's really funny. I've actually never tried Ensure, so I can't speak to it.
And for those who haven't read the book, maybe explain how Ensure features in this book. It comes up fairly often.
It does. So Giftie, one of her major experiments, one of the experiments that she's using to do her research is one that I will call the lever press experiment. And it's one where she trains mice to press a lever. And when they press this lever, they get Ensure, which the mice really love and become a bit addicted to. And then after some time, she changes the conditions. So sometimes times when the mice press the lever, they get insure. But other times when they press the lever, they get a mild foot shock. And some of the mice kind of quickly learn to stop pressing the lever. They don't want the shock anymore. The insure is not worth it. And other mice continue to press the lever despite knowing that there's the possibility of this shock. And it's those mice that continue to press the lever, continue to be addicted to the insure that Gifty uses to study addiction.
And Gifty gets, I think, really gets a fond of at least one of the mice.
Yeah, it's true. There's a mouse who Gifty, I think, kind of starts to think of as a stand-in for her brother. You know, he's a mouse who continues to press the lever and seems particularly fond of the insurer, and Gifty particularly fond of this mouse who, again, I think she's you know, prompted to think about her childhood, think about her brother's own addiction every time she sees this mouse.
Now, let's give Nyla in Madison a chance to join in. Nyla, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for inviting me into this conversation. I just really appreciated both your novels, Homegoing and Transcendent Kingdom. And in Homegoing, I really was able to expand my understanding of generational trauma, both for others and within my own family. And in Transcendent Kingdom, just kind of thinking through the loss of a family member that is still alive and how that can happen through opioid addiction, and in my own experience through actually mental illness. And thank you for the powerful writing that allowed me to kind of listen to this story and both relate within my own.
Oh.
Thank you, Nyla.
That is, thank you so much for that comment. And let's talk more. Why did you really wanted to talk about addiction in this book? Why was that important to you?
On the one hand, there was, as I mentioned before, my friend's research into addiction. I was interested in kind of thinking about how scientists approach this disease. But on the other hand, around the time that I started writing this novel, the opioid epidemic was in the news nearly daily. And it's an epidemic that we know has not disappeared. It continues to affect a large group of Americans, and it's incredibly devastating. So I think I was interested in part in exploring the effects of that epidemic on the lives of Black people who were kind of getting left out of the larger narrative of the opioid crisis.
Yeah, I think it became more of a crisis when the opioid crisis came to the white community and to rural areas. It's terrible, at which are mostly are often mostly white.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that the pieces that I was reading, you know, to 2017, 2018, I found incredibly moving, deeply humanizing. It was some of the first times that I was seeing writing around addiction being looked at as a healthcare issue and not just a criminal issue. And I think this has a lot to do with the fact that it was a crisis that has kind of arrived on the doorstep of white people in rural and suburban areas, as you said, unlike the crack epidemic of the 80s or the previous heroin epidemic of the 60s, which largely affected Black people in cities. And as we know from the writing and the reporting around that time, there was a lot of emphasis on criminality. And so I was interested in that shift and interested in kind of being able to approach the characters of this novel with the same kind of nuanced, humanizing, attentive care, but to center it on Black people.
Monica from Madison emailed, wondering about the concept of affection. She says the family sees Americans as too overt in expressing love and affection, yet Giftey questions if affection might have protected Nana. Mm-hmm. Love to hear, Monica says she'd love to hear more about the cultural tension around the family and how family love is expressed.
Yeah, that's a good question, Monica. Giftey's family, I think, is particular. Even among Ghanaians, they are kind of peculiarly unaffectionate. You know, Giftey talks about never really hearing the words "I love you," which is not uncommon, I should say. It's not the typical way of Ghanaians to say "I love you" as much as Americans do. But beyond that, you know, she doesn't get a lot of care. She doesn't get a lot of physical touch. She doesn't get a lot of hugs. Her mother's kind of unsmiling, a bit prickly, as I've described Giftey herself. And so there is a lack of overt affection. And instead, what we see is affection that comes in these smaller gestures, you know, these moments where Giftey's mother cooks for her, even though she's feeling depressed. That feels to me like a gesture of deep affection and love. So we have to read it differently. Giftey has to learn to read it differently because she's never going to get the explicit "I love you" that her classmates get. You know, she's going to get something different, and it still is love, but it's not overt.
Would you mind doing a reading, a short reading, perhaps, from your book? Maybe one that relates to Giftey and her mother, but wouldn't have to. But I'd love to hear I'd love to hear you read.
Sure, I would love to. And I'll just read from the very beginning, which is Giftey and her mother in a way. Whenever I think of my mother, I picture a queen-sized bed with her lying in it, a practiced stillness filling the room. For months on end, she colonized that bed like a virus, the first time when I was a child, and then again when I was a graduate student. The first time, I was sent to Ghana to wait her out. While there, I was walking through Kejetia Market with my aunt when she grabbed my arm and pointed. "Look, a crazy person," she said in Shwe. "Do you see a crazy person?" I was mortified. My aunt was speaking so loudly, and the man, tall, with dust caked into his dreadlocks, was within earshot. I see," I answered in a low hiss. The man continued past us, mumbling to himself as he waved his hands about in gestures that only he could understand. My aunt nodded, satisfied. And we kept walking past the hordes of people gathered in that agoraphobia-inducing market until we reached the stall where we would spend the rest of the morning attempting to sell knockoff handbags. In my 3 months there, we sold only 4 bags. Even now, I don't completely understand why my aunt singled the man out to me. Maybe she thought there were no crazy people in America, that I had never seen one before. Or maybe she was thinking about my mother, about the real reason I was stuck in Ghana that summer, sweating in a stall with an aunt I hardly knew while my mother healed at home in Alabama. Mm. I was 11, and I could see that my mother wasn't sick, not in the ways that I was used to. I didn't understand what my mother needed healing from. I didn't understand, but I did. And I'll stop there.
Oh, boy. That's a wonderful portion from your book. And depression and mental illness is so important in your book, written with such feeling. And the dealing with Giftey's dealing with the mental illness of her mother was depressing, I think, to her.
I think so. I mean, Gifty finds herself, as many of us do eventually when we are in this position of watching our parents get older, Gifty finds herself having to take care of her mother. She finds herself kind of in this role reversal where suddenly she's mothering the woman who mothered her. And it's in this case because of her mother's depression. And it is quite depressing, I think, to Gifty. You know, there's a way to read this novel as being about Gifty's own depression, not just her mother's.
Indeed. Karen in Orfordville, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I really like the book. And in many parts when I was reading it, it really was like a lot of things that I had lived through. But my question or comment is, first of all, I should tell you, I came from Rhodesia or Zimbabwe when I was 9. And I had a very hard time fitting in to life in California. In fact, I didn't speak for a year because I had such a severe accent. And I just wonder how you could do it so easily. That's my question.
Well, thank you, Karen, for your question. I think one of the things that's different in my case than in yours is that I came when I was quite young. I came when I was 2. And so I didn't have as many kind of, sturdy memories of Ghana. I hadn't grown up there enough to develop a kind of conscious memory, a conscious life there. And so for me, all of my memories begin in America. Even though Twi was my first language, I learned English very quickly and learned it without an accent. And so I never did have that that experience of having my otherness pointed out to me because of the way that I spoke. You know, I will never have an accent the way my parents do. And so I think that did kind of shield me a little bit.
And now you've lived in, you live in Brooklyn, and you certainly don't have a Brooklyn, what I would consider a Brooklyn accent.
No, I definitely don't.
Karen, thank you so much for that comment. I appreciate it very much. Yeah, Jesse is our guest today. She'll be with us right up until noon, talking with her about her book, New York Times bestseller, Transcendent Kingdom, and the University of Wisconsin's Go Big Read book for this year. Questions or comments as we move along? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mehler with Jesse, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.